afternoon, listener. Welcome to Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager on December 6, 2014. I'm Carolyn, and I'm excited to welcome Eric Hunt to the show today. Not for the first time, certainly, but certainly it has been a while since he's been here. The last time was on March 8th to discuss his new film that had just been released, titled The Treblinka Archaeology Hoax, centering on the fraudulent Caroline Sturdy Coles investigation, trying to prove the existence of homicidal gas chambers at the Treblinka transit camp. Today, Eric is going to introduce his newest film, The Majdanek Gas Chamber Myth. Before Eric calls in, I'd like to, like he's here already. Okay. All right. I'm going to answer this right now. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Oh, great. I'm glad you called in when you did. So how are you? This is Eric Hunt, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, Eric, to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
How are you feeling after finally, after just completing this this latest film that you've done, which is what, your fourth one?
Yeah, it's my fourth revisionist documentary. I'm really excited to get it out. I've been working on it since I visited Majdanek this spring. So I've been doing research and putting together this feature-length documentary. It's called The Majdanek Gas Chamber Myth. And it will be available right after your show ends, actually. So I'm really excited to show it to the revisionist community.
Well, I'm excited about it, too, and I got a sneak preview of it. And it's got a lot in there that is going to be very, very useful and helpful to people in just in, as we continue on along the exposure of the Holocaust, really. You know, one each part, and you're very good about, going after every bit of it, whereas sometimes some people need to kind of concentrate on one little part of it because it's so big. But yet the same myths and the same hoaxes, if we might say, are carried through from one part to another, right? I mean, in every part of it.
Some revisionists have said that Majdanek is a microcosm of the larger Holocaust hoax. Certainly when you look at it, and the biggest sign of this is the death toll, which originally the propaganda death toll claimed by the Soviet Union was that 2 million were gassed in a factory of death, which included 7 gas chambers. Well, thanks to a lot of revisionist research and logic, that death toll has dropped down. It's now officially the museum claim is, I believe, 72,000. This is still inflated, but it's over 20 times dropped from the original purely propaganda Soviet Union death toll. Majdanek is a microcosm of the larger hoax, and when you look at Majdanek and the precipitously dropping death toll, what do you think happens when you look at other camps? We should be seeing similar drops at places such as Auschwitz and Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor. We will, as long as we keep hammering away at this hoax.
Yeah, well, we have seen drops, but you're right. The one at Majdanek seems to be the steepest drop, and we will see that elsewhere. Once you can pry their fingers away from their, you know, their minds away from what they're trying to hang on to there, we will see similar drops because this whole death toll. Well, so then what's going to happen with the 6 million? You know, I noticed at your website, Holocaust Hoax Museum, which is at holocausthoaxmuseum.com. You have at the top, the first thing that comes up is this question about the six million number. You know, it's my idea that the people who are the Holocaust industry is unwilling to ever give up that 6 million number. So do you have any ideas about how they're going to approach that as these other numbers drop?
Well, the respectable scholars have claimed something like 5.1 or 5.2, a 5-point number to make that seem more realistic and more believable. But, I mean, it's all still completely exaggerated, a figure that revisionists have proven the 6 million figure was spread decades before World War II. This is a figure that plays in Zionism and their desire to create a Jewish state.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So, and you've got that in the museum. You're working on a big exhibit about that. But we know there's been a lot of talk about that. There's the book, whatever that book is that somebody wrote. A very good one. The first Holocaust.
John Hedishaw.
Right. And it points all that out. To me, things like that are just mind-boggling. It's just convincing in itself, right there, just that the whole thing is made up. But yet, it doesn't get out to the people like it should, does it? That's what it seems
to
me.
I'm seeing a lot of younger people, in their teenagers, people in their 20s, and they're seeing their future taken away from them, and they're starting to question what's happening in this world, in the Western world in particular, what's going on. And I think there's a lot of growth in people questioning the Holocaust hoax.
But you might be right, Eric. It's in the young people, and as the young people are taking in all this information more and more, and they use these alternative media more and more, that this is what will do it. And so many times it's been that. In fact, we were even reading about Adolf Hitler and the National Socialism the other day. His idea that once this new generation that's been brought up, in the Third Reich, the youngsters get 10 or 20 years in the future, they're going to be the strongest, most, strongest Germans that ever lived and will be standing up for what they believe and so on. And it's the same with everything. If you can educate your youth, which is why, though, the other side of it is the Zionists understand that too, and they're trying to do that exact same thing. But I think that the youth are be more likely to follow what you're teaching than to follow the Zionists.
I think there are a few developments: the internet, the decline of traditional Jewish monopoly media are huge. Actually, I think that's the biggest thing that is enabling the growth of the revisionist message. And they're not going to be able to just have their propaganda films 24/7 on the History Channel, the American Heroes Channel, things like this. The younger generation is able to just go on YouTube or look up information at sites such as mine Kodo or any of these forums. And if you saw recently in California, high school kids were assigned to write whether the Holocaust was a hoax or not, and many of them came to the conclusion that it was. And the ADL, which is a big fan of your shows and mine, had to go into damage control and go into this high school and re-educate these young people who came to our message, the truth.
Yeah, that's right. And here's another example of it. I'm glad this has fallen into place in this way, because I wanted to mention this article, which I saw in the Times of Israel. .com. Well, these people send them, so I don't go looking there. But it's titled Holocaust Museum Gets $25 Million Donation. Well, apparently this is the largest single donation from an individual in the museum, U.S. Holocaust Museum's history. And it comes from the William Levine family of Phoenix. It's going to be used, guess what, to expand and diversify its reach, especially to young people. That's what the museum says. And so here you've got this investor, real estate developer, who's giving this huge donation, $25 million. I guess, you know, we're lucky to get, you're lucky to get $2,500. You'd be thrilled, I'm sure, if you got that much from somebody. So, but they get it all the time. Plus, they get supported by the U.S. government. If they're ever falling short, they'll come through with some extra, I'm sure. But he says, this man says that he has distinct memories of when he first learned about the Holocaust as a young student at the yeshiva of Flatbush, New York, during World War II. So he was a kid during World War II, and they were telling him about it. He says, it was hard to believe what was happening to the Jews of Europe. I guess it was hard to believe, you know, because it's not believable. Yeah. And then he says, even today, it seems unthinkable, and that's why education is so important. Well, what he's saying there is, it's not believable, and that's why they have to keep up this education. You know, I thought that was really interesting, and so, and then it says, the last sentence, let me just add this, the Levine family gift is part of the museum's $514 million campaign led by honorary chair Elie Wiesel. Now, I don't know what that. Oh, they're trying to raise $540, or they have, and this has helped them to reach that goal or something. This is the kind of money these people are dealing with.
So. Yeah, it's a multi-billion-dollar scam. It is unbelievable. It is impossible. It's gas chambers disguised as shower rooms. When you look at it, it's actually quite stupid. In particular, the Maidanek story, the story about showers and gas, it just all falls apart when you actually study it and look into what really happened at these camps. Before the war, I mean, and while the war was happening, no one, even the news agencies such as the BBC, actually believed these propaganda reports about Jews being gassed in showers. It was only until the camps were captured by the victorious Allies that these atrocity rumors, propaganda, found believability. This is, of course, after these buildings at some of these camps were heavily modified by both the Soviet Union and the Americans. But it's funny how you say these, you point out these words that these people use, unbelievable. Can't imagine. I think there's a whole study of these. There should be a whole study of these words that people are using, because they show the cognitive dissonance. These people subconsciously, they're really trying to question. Well, were these people really gassed in showers? Does this really make sense? So a lot of the words these people use, especially these promoters use, unbelievable, unimaginable, they really portray that this is a big lie, and that they even they don't believe
that
it.
Yeah, they can't. They can't. Unthinkable. Here was another one. They can't believe it.
Yeah,
and they have to know if they have any intelligence that so that, and they must have picked up somewhere too, maybe, hopefully, you know, that there's so much contradiction in what's been said. And so they know it, but they don't want to admit it. So they have to just keep pushing The education to get other people to believe it. And if other people will believe it, then it's okay. You know, you can believe
like
it, too.
Well, like you said, most people are taught this as children. It's quite traumatic. It's like mind molestation. They create this trauma in children that leaves an imprint in their minds that they never dare question this. And in fact, they get violently opposed to people who actually try to shine a light on this big lie. So they target children that, you know, some of them are in middle school or even before middle school who don't know anything about war or barely just learned how to read and. They target them with this propaganda, such as the boy with the striped pajamas, this horror movie aimed at children, which shows children being gassed. I was actually just horrified when I just recently watched this new propaganda film. But they target children because adults would ask questions and be somewhat skeptical. It's very much like religion in that respect.
Yeah, huh? And you know, I was just looking at the Maidanic pages on your site, but also brought my attention to the poster or the front the cover of your video for the new Maidanic gas chamber myth, and how interesting it is. And talking about how they treat children and adults too, you've got this. If people see it, it's at the bottom of the front page of your site, HolocaustHoaxMuseum.com, and it's bright red. At the bottom, there's the three videos, and it's the last one. And you did a great job designing this with this this water pipe coming down and watering this person's brain because the top of his head is removed, so his brain shows. It's just a kind of a cartoon image. But it's like, I guess that's what you call brainwashing, right? And
exactly,
that's what
we're
dealing with. That's what you were just talking about. That's what they're doing. When they do it to little children, they have no defenses whatsoever.
No, they're just... they're a captive audience, so when Irene Zisblatt comes in and just completely lies, just tells the most absurd lies one after the other about defecating diamonds and being thrown over an electrified barbed wire fence after escaping from inside a gas chamber, being selected to become a lampshade, these kids don't know any better. They trust the adults. They trust their teachers to be telling them the truth. And, wow, they're horrified. They're told that this woman was selected to have her eye color changed because she wasn't Aryan enough. So these people are taught these lies. They're taught to hate their own people and feel guilt at a very early age for something that they had nothing to do and is not true. It's a blood libel against the German people.
Yeah, it's a criminal thing. It's criminal to do this. It's criminal to lie in this way to little children and then have it be a part of something that they carry on so that all their lives they're not able to free themselves from this. And of course, it poisons relationships and so on, and even relationships between different people. Different nations and nationalities and races and everything. So it's just a horrible crime. It's not, you know, this is why I always think that if this thing gets, you know, exposed to enough degree that they have to admit to a lot of it, that it shouldn't be just a little pat on the hand and say, well, we understand you were upset, you know, that a lot of these people did all that lying because they were angry at what had happened to them, that they had been arrested, that they were deported, and so on. And you can understand them being angry about it. I also like to point out the other side of it, why the Germans were doing it, and then yet there should be a debate, maybe, or question as to whether the Germans had the right to do it, to remove Jews from not only Germany, then from Europe, since they had whatever areas they had occupied, they wanted to remove the Jews from there. Now that's a big question. I'm not going to get you caught up in that today, but they are angry. They are just plain angry, and so they told a bunch of stories that weren't true. And this was used by those in power to create a political power out of the whole thing. And it's very big. It's probably the biggest thing going on in the world because it has to do with the whole political position of the political powers of the world today. So yeah. you don't get any bigger than this.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, Israel is located at the center of the world, you could say, and of course we've seen all the wars that have been pushed by these so-called neocons in America. We see the clash of civilizations, and of course now we see the white guilt campaign that's led by these Jewish media oligarchs who have a monopoly over Western media, and of course the murder of innocent Palestinians by the thousands this summer was a recent horrifying development.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, as far as Western people, we are in bad shape unless we unite against this libel against our people and try to fight against these. They're just causing so much misery and death and destruction all over the world, and they use this Holocaust story as like an offensive shield to allow them to get away with their own crimes, including the ones that happened during World War II.
Well, yeah, so they hold Europe and Europeans hostage to doing anything about what they want to do in the Middle East. And they do want to expand their territory, but they don't want to appear to be just outright killing people because their whole thing about themselves is that they're the victims. And so they can't appear, you know, they can't lose that. So they go about it in the way they do, slowly. They don't fool many, you know, many people are not fooled, but obviously a lot of people are thinking, oh, they're still the victims and they're being... They've got, well, it was just, I just recently saw a video that was actually kind of old, but by Rush Limbaugh, that after he was wined and dined by the Israelites, whatever, and went on one of those trips, this was back in the 80s or something, went on one of those trips to Israel. He came back, you know, with the whole story and all, telling Israel's story and how poor little Israel is this little tiny country there that they insisted on having their place there. You know, they insisted on that. And it was even smaller then. There was more for the Palestinians at that time. And they're surrounded by all these big Arabs who hate them and want to destroy them. Well, why do they want to destroy them and hate them? Because they're trying to take over and expand and doing it at the expense of the Arabs. They had several wars there, and they've got the friendship of the Americans, and the whole thing is it just goes on and on like this. What point was I trying to make here? But that they use that idea that they're under attack there when they're actually the attackers. And so here we have the same thing with the Holocaust and World War II, that the Jews were attacking Germany, and they were attacking all of European civilization in a lot of ways. And so they were disliked. They didn't want them there. You can't defend yourself. What I'm going on and on now, but you can't defend yourself against a united Jewry. If they are united in achieving their goals, it seems as though the truth of the matter is that no matter how much Europeans outnumbered the Jews that were there, they couldn't defend themselves against the shenanigans and the Jews from taking over more and more power. And in some cases, you know, they were kicked out of countries in the past, and nobody thinks that was so terrible. But they went somewhere else.
Country,
and so, and so the Germans knew they couldn't just send them next door, so they're trying to figure out where to send them so that they couldn't operate in another local area. And all this is necessary to be studied, at least to get people over the fact that the Jews were totally mistreated for no reason of their own, you know, for nothing that they did. They didn't do anything. They just got picked on by mean people who had racial ideas.
You can see what happens when Jews get power over society. You can see the Western people are being driven into minority status in their own countries as they have ceded power to, you know, billionaire Jewish media owners and, of course, the lobbyists and politicians. So it's a really bad idea to give up power to this hostile people.
It is. And as I really think in studying all of this, that as much as people don't want to, they're not able to prevent it because they don't. We don't have that kind of tight networking that Jewish groups do. But, well, that's another subject, I guess. Let's. I would like.
I don't know
to
if
go,
it is though.
Well, no, it does go in, but I just. Yeah.
That's important because I mean, you know, Jews are taught that Jewish nationalism is the highest virtue, but the opposite, of course, is equated with throwing babies into gas chambers. I mean, European nationalism is equated with these bogus atrocity stories about wanting to gas women and babies in shower rooms. So it's hugely important, I think, that point.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It is. That needs to be taken into consideration. So now we're ending our first half hour, and I've said that we would take calls in the second hour, Eric. And if people do want to call in the second hour, after the second hour, I'll give you the phone number now. It is 323-642-1206. 323-642-1206, but not until the second hour. So, from the next in the next half hour, let's go over, I want you to go over what took place at Majdanek and what the story is there. What's in your film?
Hey. Yeah.
Okay.
So Majdanek was the first major concentration camp liberated by the Allies when the Soviet Union. You know, those always trustworthy truth tellers, the Soviet Union, liberated the camp. Supposedly, they claimed 2 million were gassed in a factory of death, which included 7 homicidal gas chambers. But because Majdanek was captured mostly intact, buildings and a great deal of documents and physical evidence still exist, which has helped acquit the Germans of this gas chambers disguised as shower rooms propaganda. So revisionists have forced the museum to back away from claiming that 5 of the 7 quote gas chambers ever served as homicidal gas chambers. So now the Majdanek Museum and the Holocaust industry, they're down to 2 alleged homicidal gas chambers at Majdanek. But of course, when you look at these other 2 alleged homicidal gas chambers, well, they're not anything what the Holocaust industry claims. So the gas chambers that are currently alleged to have been used to gas prisoners at Majdanek are located in a normal, everyday, common B. Lausing facility. that was located at the entrance to the camp. It was labeled as Bath and Disinfection 1. Now, Bath and Disinfection 1 was a life-saving delousing facility located right at the entrance to the camp. So these were at many of the camps, both in Germany, and Americans had this in France, and even the British had similar delousing facilities at camps in occupied Palestine.
And let me just say, Eric, that people, the listeners, can follow a lot of this and see a lot of pictures by going to your site, the Mydanic Virtual Tour. And there's a lot of pictures that help explain. Of course, when they see your video, that's putting it all together. But we'll just do it this way for now. They can see how this is very important, what you just said, that because the camp was close to the town, the city, and close then to the train station, they were able to just walk the prisoners to the camp. And as soon as they entered the camp, that's where they would go directly to this bath and disinfection place, which is at that end of the camp, which made sense, you see. So that's what they did first. And then the crematory, as you're going to tell us, is all the way at the other end. So anyway, sorry for I wanted to just point out that people can look at these pictures as you're talking.
That's good, so it's called Bath and Disinfection 1. It's just a normal delousing facility. You know, prisoners would remove their clothing, which was placed in the delousing chambers. Then they would get their hair cut to remove any areas where deadly typhus-carrying lice could thrive and kill these people. Then they took a shower, a hot shower, to remove any dirt, bacteria, and, of course, the all-important body lice, which is the most important thing to remove. Typhus epidemics were devastating, especially the Jewish population, but, of course, also German guards and Poles and people all around Europe, both during World War II and before. Millions died in World War I from typhus. And then after taking a hot shower, they dunked in these bathtubs with disinfestation fluid. Then they put on lice-free clothing and be led into the camp proper. So there's nothing homicidal whatsoever about this Bath and Disinfection 1 building. In fact, it was used to save prisoner lives. The only gas chambers in this facility were used with the pesticide Zyklon B, which was used even in America to kill pests, insects, to save human lives.
All right.
And it's just absurd that at Mydanic that they're claiming this Bath and Disinfection 1 building was secretly, deceptively used to trick Jews into getting gassed. The most important thing in my video is pointing out that what the museum and the Holocaust industry claims. The Holocaust industry claims that Jews were tricked into getting undressed and then taking a shower because the shower opens the pores and allows the cyanide gas to work quicker. They've got some other silly excuses to why people were allegedly showered before then walking into supposedly gas chambers. The thing that is really important to point out and actually destroys any of their claims about extermination going on at Mydanic is that existing plans from the Bath and Disinfection 2 facility, which is located right next to this Bath and Disinfection 1 complex, it proves that the museum is mislabeling rooms and actually, while occupied by the Soviet Union, they actually modified this building to make tourists walk through this facility the opposite way that prisoners were actually sent through these delousing facilities. So the museum and wants people to believe that prisoners went in the opposite way than they actually did, that they went into showers, then they were gassed. But in reality, they went the opposite way. They walked away from the clothing delousing chambers, then they took showers, and then they were led into the camp. So this is huge. They are not going to be able to get away with this much longer. It hasn't really been pointed out in a way for people to really see visually, to understand. This new video is going to really help. They're in real trouble with this shower gas chamber claim at Majdanek. They're really stuck. They can't continue claiming that prisoners walk through this the opposite way. It's just absolutely impossible according to the plan and the general way that the delousing facilities were used, with a clean side and an unclean side. So they actually boarded up the original entrance to the bathroom disinfection 2 facility. They've closed the entire bathroom disinfection 2 facility, and they created a modification which connects the, you know, life-saving shower room and undressing room area with the clothing delousing rooms, trying to make people believe that prisoners were tricked into showering before being led into gas chambers. But in fact, they walked the opposite way, and this building modification wasn't even there during the camp's operation. So,
right, so they just bypassed the clothing disinfection building, which was that little brick building. And they there was a space, you know, there was space between the two buildings, and then there was a big door in the disinfection bath in the bath building, a sign and so on, and they went in there, and what they did was undress and take a shower, and then come out and put the clean clothing on, and then go on into the camp, like you just said. So, I mean, they just they totally destroyed. They changed what was there in order to make their false narrative about it. So,
absolutely.
It's an amazing story, really.
It's incredible.
You do such a great job. You have these wonderful diagrams and all kinds of photographs, and you point it out very clearly. You can't misunderstanding it if you look at it. It's all in the film.
Yeah, I did a little 3D animation there that shows where the original entrance was and how the modification was added. This modification is admitted to have been added by the museum. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think they've actually been really confronted that the rooms are mislabeled and that people actually went through the opposite way. Carla Matonio and Jürgen Graf wrote their book about Majdanek, which has helped really drop the outrageously inflated propaganda death toll. But I don't think the Majdanek Museum really has been forced to look at this information that they're mislabeling these rooms, that people went through the opposite way. And of course, I think they're hoping that the revisionists wouldn't create easy-to-understand videos such as this to actually show how these gullible soldiers are tricked into believing this nonsense, walking through the exit side and just being told lies about every single room that they walk through.
Yeah. Well, right. And I love your little drawing there that you call your 3D... whatever art, it just makes it so clear. I like it. I like the way you do your artwork. Now, the thing is, when did this book by Matonio and Graf come out? It was in the 90s, wasn't it? Their book on Majdanek?
I believe it was 1998. I believe it was 1998.
Right.
The museum changed the death toll in 2005. And it's obvious. Tomas Kranz, he's the research director of the Majdanek State Museum. He's read this book, and he's been confronted with a lot of their facts and great research, and they've been forced to take away 5 of the 7 originally alleged gas chambers. Some of them are absurdly stupid, and now they're really they're the revisionists, really. They've become the revisionists, completely revising their original, purely propaganda, silly narrative.
Yes. Yes, and well, you know, it'd be kind of interesting to go into the propaganda part, but maybe we'll see. We'll wait until later if we need to fill in some.
We could talk about some of the fake gas chambers that were alleged to have been used to gas prisoners for almost 60 years at Majdanek. There's the undressing room, which has a window in it and wooden doors and a room within a room. This room it wasn't originally designed to be a delousing chamber, but it was used as this. And the museum claimed that Zyklon B was dropped through holes in the ceiling to gas prisoners. And only a few years ago have they admitted that these holes in the ceiling were actually just ventilation holes to get the cyanide gas out of the room after delousing clothing. Now they claim no one was ever gassed in this room. So it's completely opposite from the original story. And there are several more rooms that are fake gas chambers that were claimed to have been used to gas Jews. There's one inside the crematorium, which is actually at the opposite. The new crematorium is located at the opposite end of the camp, uphill from this bath and disinfection building. Inside, there was a room inside the crematorium, which they claimed was used as a gas chamber until only a few years ago. And this has a crudely hacked into the ceiling hole. But now the museum has backed away from claiming this ever served as a gas chamber. And it's obvious this hole in the ceiling was a post-liberation fake in order to frame the Germans. Well, if you look at this hole, one of the holes in one of the currently alleged gas chambers looks very similar. It's this crudely cut hole. The rebar is still in the ceiling. They didn't even have tools to properly cut the rebar out of the ceiling. And actually, behind one of these currently alleged gas chambers, there's another room with a hole in the ceiling similar to this. Well, they backed away from claiming that was ever used as a homicidal gas chamber. So you've got these holes in the ceiling, which were clearly made after liberation. Another one of these post-liberation building modifications. And then the other currently alleged homicidal gas chamber doesn't even have any holes in the ceiling. So it's a complete joke. And
you wonder why they're so sloppy. You know, the first I heard about holes in the ceilings of so-called alleged gas chambers were the crematoriums at the Birkenau. And, you know, that got a lot of attention, at least among revisionists, and all the pictures of these holes that were kind of beat in there, you know, and the rebar being pulled up, and they're still showing and so on, just sloppy, and saying that these were the so-called holes that were used to put this poison down in there, the powder. It's ridiculous. And then here at Majdanek, it seems to be even worse. And why would they, why, and before you were telling us about some sloppy work that they did earlier, and it's true that that these, in Poland, they do this really sloppy work, and it was the Soviets, you know, in charge of it too. Together they were doing it. And why don't they, you know, what is the problem? Why would you say that they don't do a better job of it so that they can be more convincing? They don't think anybody's going to question them, I guess. Or did they think this was only temporary and they were just, they didn't think, they weren't thinking so far ahead that 60, 70 years from now they were still going to be promoting this this business?
Yeah, I think that, you said it. It's just, it was quickly done. They didn't have the proper tools. They wanted to do some of these modifications before the Polish-Soviet Commission wanted to create their report for all these Western journalists. So they had a window of a few days, really, to look at these rooms. Then they'd realize, wait, there's no way to actually put Zyklon into these rooms. Well, we have to put holes in into the ceiling. So it was just quickly put together. I think that's the best explanation.
Yeah, I sometimes think that they thought they were just doing something for the trial and the end of the war stuff and everything, and that they had no concept of it continuing way on into the future, or is that anybody would be interested or pay attention. I don't know. That's just a thought I have.
Yeah, maybe they just thought they'd always have this media monopoly and tyrannical governments that can lock people up who question the lie. In many aspects, they're right. You think about that, and 7 years later, they still have a media monopoly, and you can be locked into prison for questioning this propaganda hoax. So,
or another thought, they might have been used to dealing with their own people, and with people of a Western mindset as much. Mm-hmm. And you know, the question started with French people in France right away with that Rassinier and another one. Can't think of his name right at the moment. They're more questioning mind, and they were used to people who just accepted whatever they said and didn't have the ability to look things up and so on. That could be part of it. They're a different kind of a mindset that was creating this stuff. They did stupid things in the West, though, too. And like you've got on your video, that what went on in France, and, of course, we've seen all these really stupid U.S. Army videos showing just making ridiculous claims that nobody would believe. So I guess my theory doesn't really hold up. They're all the same.
I mean, the Soviets were sort of disconnected from the world. They certainly weren't as advanced in many respects as the Germans were as far as engineering and technology. There are many reports that when the Soviets came across flushing toilets, they didn't even know what they were, and they were washing mm-hmm. their hands in them.
Right.
So,
well, that's understandable. You wouldn't know.
Yeah.
If you've never seen one, you'd think, well, here's some water. Yeah. We're supposed to clean up here.
Sure.
But, that's another thing about the typhus, Eric, that I wouldn't mind bringing up, but it doesn't go along with the fake concentration camp here. But, the typhus was something that these people carried. And somewhere in the Matonio graph book, I read, I think that's where it was, that it was those most liable to bring typhus or to have typhus or whatever were the Russians, the Poles, and the Romanians. And probably more the Jewish element of those too. But, you know, from those countries, they just didn't have the same level of let's face it, cleanliness, you know, and they didn't understand it either. And so they were real bad carriers. And they're the people who brought this stuff into the camps. And more the Russians, actually, I think. Every time they brought Russian POWs into a camp, a typhus would break out because they couldn't seem to eradicate it sufficiently from these people. They were covered with it.
As Friedrich Paul Berg has pointed out in his essay, Typhus and the Jews, the Jews were very resistant to hygiene measures at this time. They were actually had a quite filthy hygiene standards by today's standard. You think about these people with their, of course, in some of the Orthodox and Hasidic communities, they had this long hair. They had to have this long hair by because of their religion. So this is one of the aspects that actually led to a lot of them dying. They resisted these hygiene measures at the camps, showering, things like this. And even General Patton pointed out how filthy this community was when he came across them, and how their hygiene standards, they were defecating in public and didn't really have any modern civilized sort of hygiene standards. So this is talked about in Friedrich Paul Berg's article, Typhus and the Jews.
And I think that's important to realize and should be said. So I really always have appreciated Berg's work on typhus and a lot of his other work too, but he's really done great work on the typhus. And he's not afraid to say things. I'm always afraid that I'm going to be seen as, being so, picking on people because of their nationality or race or whatever. So I'm kind of hesitant about it. But like so many of these Holocaust survivors that you have in these videos, in general, what happened from World War II is that all of these Eastern Jews from the countries I just named and others moved into the West, and then as they had another generation and so on, they grew up in the West and they learned all these standards. And now you think, well, these are all such nice appearing people, what's wrong with them? Why would they be? But they didn't look like that then. We have pictures of a lot of these people, but they didn't live like that, and they didn't have, they weren't clean. They really weren't. And the Germans were, as you did bring out, also lost their own people. A lot of SS guards and men and so on succumbed to typhus because they were dealing with these people. And they are trying their very best to eradicate this and to keep these people clean and disinfected and so on. And that's what the whole program was. Sometimes I think about it, I think, it wasn't worth it. But if they wanted to move these people and they wanted to utilize them for labor, they had to do it. So that's what they were all, that's basically what was going on at Majdanek most of the time, right? Trying to prepare people to work. Particularly by the 43 in the armaments. And they said they had I was reading in the Metonia book that somebody had written a report in SS Man that they, now, sometime in 1943, maybe March or something, they really had it set up. They really had a lot of work getting done in the armaments factories and so on, and everything was moving, and that they were not going to be able to let up on that, that this was going to have to be a continuing process to utilize people for labor, which is called, of course, slave labor, and another thing that's held against them. But in order to survive it by then, they needed to do it. Mm-hmm.
The Lublin district had a variety of forced labor camps, and some didn't have to work, as I show in the video. You can see children's bunks at Majdanek, and there are pictures and of children, infants, survivors, quote, of the camp, just like Americans put Japanese Americans in concentration camps in the West. Jews were put into concentration camps by the Germans. Some were put to forced labor, some weren't. That's all that happened, really. There's obviously no gassing or in shower rooms, that's for sure.
Well, that's another thing. And, you know, they selected out those who could be used for labor. And then the rest, they didn't exterminate or kill the rest of the people. They didn't kill the children. They didn't kill the women or the old people. So they had to have those people that look after those people. What can you tell us about those people? Maybe that has something to do with the little castle. They were given things to do, because it doesn't look like that little castle was done by, you know, any great architectural minds or anything, but at least people put a lot of effort and imagination into it.
Yeah, I mean, some of these people were just sitting out the war. Some didn't have to work. So at Majdanek, there are some sculptures that were made by the prisoners. The Germans gave them all the supplies to do this, all the time to do this. So at Majdanek, you've got it's about a 7-foot-tall castle. It's a German-style castle made out of concrete. It's rather large sculpture that the prisoners made in 1943. There's another sculpture. It's about 4 or 5 feet wide, 3 feet tall. It's of a turtle. So some of these people that were just sitting out the war in these concentration camps were involved with some of these artistic and cultural activities.
Yeah. All right. So we've got that. Now, we haven't really talked about the crematory yet, have we?
No.
Or have you? No.
Okay. No, we haven't really talked about it. But, of course, the original claim... The new crematorium at Majdanek was burned by the Germans shortly before abandoning the camp. When the Polish Soviet Commission was showing Western journalists around, of course, the Soviets made great effort to stack human skulls and into like a pyramid structure. I'm sure some people have seen some of these photographs. To get this propaganda imagery, they claim that the 5 crematory ovens were used to get rid of 2,000 people in a single day. Every day, they claim 2,000 people were cremated in these ovens. And you know, these Western journalists, Stalin called these types useful idiots. They believed everything the Soviets told them, including these impossible cremation times. If we generously estimate that a body could be cremated in 1 hour, and you've got 5 ovens, even if they were working 24 hours a day, well, maybe 100 could be cremated in these ovens in a single day. Maybe. That's far from the claim that 2,000 a day were cremated there, and this just exposes how the original Polish Soviet Commission is completely ridiculous, just pure propaganda and absolute
nonsense.
I'm sorry
to interrupt you, Eric, but I just went back over to the studio page and I saw we had a caller, and it's just one hour mark. So we'll remember to get back to the cremation part again, let me welcome this caller. Hi, caller. Where are you calling from? I don't want to, you know, if you're just listening, you can at least answer me, because I don't want people...
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, but okay, I had it on mute. That's why you couldn't hear me.
Oh. No,
I'm just a listener, and I'm enjoying the show for the first time. I've never heard of Mr. Hunt before, but he's bringing forth some very interesting points. And being of the Americans' descendant, I just want to know more about it.
That's fine.
And, you know, there's some things that I heard that, when I think about when they use the word Jewish, I'm wondering what would be the Jewish nationality. But they always just use just the word Jewish. So I'm wondering, you know, as he's bringing forth some pretty good things about it was impossible for any type of this ethnic cleansing, that, you know, he's bringing right some pretty good points. So I'll go back to continue listening.
All right, so you've never heard of Eric Hunt before, huh?
No, not at all. First time.
Oh.
And I, you know,
wow. All right. Well, you need to listen then.
Okay.
Well,
then
you
I will.
Just go ahead and listen.
He can watch my other videos. I've made some other videos, and this video about my Donic will be released at the end of this show. So if you want to see some of my videos, I really recommend The Last Days of the Big Lie in particular, if you want to see how African Americans are used by the Holocaust industry. I point out in particular in my video, The Last Days of the Big Lie, there's an African American soldier who featured in Steven Spielberg's Oscar-winning film, The Last Days, who's used to promote this, so it might be of special interest to you. So I recommend you check out that video, The Last Days of the Big Lie.
Right, yes, definitely. He shouldn't. Anybody who's coming upon this for the first time or should watch that video. In fact, watch that video first. That's the first one you did. It's really great. It's quite a classic, so that's important. So, we'll go back to talking about the cremation building.
All right,
Eric.
Yeah. So you've got five ovens. You know, they had typhus epidemics at this camp, so people were dropping like flies, actually, because of diseases such as dysentery. Pneumonia and the big one, typhus, typhoid fever. And of course, the hygiene conditions at this camp were pretty bad. In fact, they were terrible. In fact, the conditions only improved in 1943 when the main camp, Majdanek, was connected to the sewer system of Lublin. So the prisoners didn't really have running water in their barracks.
I have a question about that, and I don't understand that most barracks never had running water.
Well,
in fact,
at
Berkenau, as I understand, it was only some of the women's barracks, the ones that were built of brick, that had a toilet at one end of the barrack for the women. Otherwise, they all went out to other buildings to do washing and all of that. Personal hygiene and so on, but yet for most people they could keep it fairly clean. But then other people, depending on who was there, were not as clean. So, but I don't know the situation. I don't know that they had. I don't know how the sewage was at Auschwitz-Birkenau. You might.
I don't know particularly too much about that, but. You know, you've got these prisoner of war camps that were hastily constructed, overcrowded. You know, these conditions are not only confined to German-run prisoner of war camps during World War II. We've got a case in America during the Civil War. You've got the Andersonville prison, which was the site of the death of 13,000 Union soldiers. How did they die? Were they gassed in shower rooms? No. They died because the hygiene conditions were terrible. They didn't really have access to proper water facilities, things like this, and they died of scurvy, dysentery. In fact, there's a famous image of an Andersonville survivor, and he's emaciated human skeleton. Well, he looks quite similar to these very famous images we see of these Holocaust survivors that were liberated in the West. Well, why do they look so similar? Well, they were suffering from the very same diseases at the time. So there's prisoner of war camps, especially in active war zones, this is a common occurrence. It's nothing about an extermination program. It's terrible. It's one of the cruel realities of war.
Yeah, and if they weren't on the city sewage, which said the mayor of the city who was a German by then, it was all occupied by Germany, did not want to put that camp on the city sewage system because he thought it would damage the system for the people in the city. And so he got his way, so they must have thought that it was what they were doing would be sufficient. But it turned out that it's just Matonio and Graf who say that it was very bad. The hygiene was very bad, but they don't go, that I couldn't see that they went into any detail about it. And I would like to know more about it than just accept that it was particularly bad there because of that one reason, because I don't know what kind of sewage systems they had elsewhere. They must have had something going on there. I don't know. They must have had some place for water to run off and, you know, wastewater and so on. But there's no description of all that. So I'm a little, it bothers me a little bit to just keep saying that it was so terrible there without knowing.
I think Jürgen Graf wrote about this in articles that are separate from their book about Majdanek. He wrote more about the specific hygiene conditions. At the very beginning of the camp's operation in 1941, there were, I believe, Soviet prisoners who, they had a really high death toll because of the, basically this camp was put together hastily.
Yeah.
And they really didn't have much of anything as far as hygiene or washing facility, things like this, and of course sewage. So,
came together. There wasn't very good planning. It was kind of in a rush, and then this happened and that happened and things kept changing, and they never really got a good handle on it. It was pretty far east too. Well, I would like to read those things by Jürgen Graf that you. So if you come across them or can tell me where to find them, I'd like to read more about that to educate myself.
Okay. Yeah.
In any case, though, it's considered that they say 42,000 deaths in over the 3.5 years. So is that considered exceptionally high for these concentration camps?
Well, according to Jürgen Graf, Majdanek had the highest death toll of any of the major concentration camps because of the atrocious sanitary conditions at the beginning, which were improved. You can see in the video that several companies were brought in to improve the hygiene conditions at the camp, to add running water, add heating to the barracks, to improve the living conditions that were pretty bad at the beginning.
Yeah, and they had these people working, and of course those notices that we need to keep these people in the best of health and blah, blah, that went out, that was all either in late 42 or 43, was that in 1942 already that they were?
I'm not exactly sure about the date, but I know Himmler issued an order to do everything they can to stop the high death tolls at some of the camps.
And I've got all that stuff written here if I could find it. But you go ahead, and I'll look for it.
Okay. Another interesting side note about Majdanek is there are some trenches that they claim over 18,000 people were murdered, I guess machine gunned, in a single day. They call this the Operation Harvest Festival, and this is disputed by revisionists. There's some evidence that these trenches were actually used as fortifications, anti-aircraft fortifications. And as far as Operation Harvest Festival, I don't get into it too much in the video, but this is a code word, supposedly. The Germans celebrated this holiday. It's called the Harvest Festival. It's similar to Thanksgiving in America, but they're claiming this is a code word that described the mass machine gunning of perfectly healthy workers from the Lublin district in one day. 18,000 were massacred, but the evidence for this is extremely flimsy. some would say non-existent. Next to these trenches is a monument which looks like a giant flying saucer, and this is called the Ash Mound. There's a large pile of some substance they claim are ashes from the cremated and gassed Jews. But of course, this is just Soviet-style theatrical propaganda, which was created when the death toll was multiple times higher than it is today. If you look at this so-called ash mound, first of all, it's impossible for this to actually be ash. All of it would have blown away. And this wasn't just lying there when the camp was liberated, a huge mountain of ash. It's absolutely ridiculous. When you look at the pile, there's just rocks, and it's littered with concrete, rocks, broken glass, and it's largely not ashes. There are some bones in the pile, of course. As we said, many people, tens of thousands, approximately 40,000, did die over the 3 years of the camp's operation. So there are bones in this pile. It's just theatrical propaganda, and it's, of course, not really all human ash.
No, it's another big hoax. You know, to call it, what do they call it even, the ash pile
the
or something?
Ash mounds. Ash
the ash mounds. And where, you know, I'm looking at these, the photographs you took are really interesting. But where are the ashes? Are they in that spaceship-looking thing, or are they in the base of the whole thing underneath it?
Well, there's like this dome that sort of is over this ash mound. There's a little gap where air could come in and blow away if it was actually really ash. It's some sort of other material, mostly probably some sort of I can't really speculate but the majority of the material in there cannot be human ash. It's just absurd. It's Soviet propaganda, plain and simple.
So the ash mound, though, the pile of rubble, is underneath the spaceship-looking thing?
The spaceship-looking thing is like a dome that covers the, basically, it's a similar-shaped dome of ash. You could say, you could see in the video how it's situated.
Okay. Yeah, so people are supposed to walk up those steps and look at the ashes, huh?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
They're supposed to just cry and...
you look at those ashes and just... Yeah, there's something grotesque about that they've got this pile and think that's human. Talk about looking at the shoes and the stuff like that. This is worse. We're looking at the actual ashes of the people, supposedly.
Well, if you're gullible, this is going to make an imprint on you your entire life. You know, in the past, it was a lot more gruesome. Inside the crematorium, they used to have bones and human skulls and things in a glass display for people to look at. They have a covered-up box there now that is some sort of shrine. Yeah, people did die there. People died all around Europe. It was the worst war in human history. People died everywhere.
Yeah, right. Okay, you talked about the Harvest Festival, which is another scam thing that doesn't mean anything. And then
we didn't talk about the shoes.
The shoes?
Sure, if you'd like. Or what else would you?
Yeah, the shoes, because there was a shoe factory there, right?
So when the Soviets came across Majdanek, captured Majdanek, they found tens of thousands of shoes stacked up in a room. They claimed, and they still claim, that these are the shoes of murdered victims of the Germans, gassed victims of this so-called Action Reinhardt. But if you look at my Donick right across from the barracks where these shoes are on display, there's a shoemaker's workshop. Now, this doesn't mean that these shoes were all made at my Donick. What happened were that prisoner's shoes were confiscated, basically because they were valuable and they could be used to further the German war economy and the war effort. Prisoners were given inexpensive replacement shoes, which were made of lower quality materials. Some of them were actually wooden clogs. So these higher quality leather shoes that were confiscated were confiscated by the Germans to try and help them win the war, whether they sent some of the higher quality materials to the Eastern Front and the German soldiers, or they sent some of the materials back to Germany. They're not proof any of the owners were murdered whatsoever. Prisoners were given replacement shoes. This happens even at modern jails and prisons today. Prisoners are given prison shoes.
I don't know. They make it sound like those shoes were practically unwearable. They don't sound good, wooden clogs, although there are people who get used to walking around in wooden clogs, what? And they had pretty sturdy-looking tops to them. But why didn't they want them to wear their own shoes? I think a lot of people did have their own shoes in a lot of places.
Yes. Yeah, some did keep their own shoes. Of course, all the shoes had to be put in the disinfestation chambers to be deloused. That's one of the reasons they confiscated them. Some prisoners at some camps were given back their same shoes. They would tie the shoelaces together, so they would get them at the end of the delousing process. You know, basically the Germans, these leather shoes were worth money to them, so they could use these shoes to further their war economy. They also could recycle some of the leather and other materials in the shoes to make new shoes and also to repair worn-out shoes of soldiers on the Eastern Front.
Right. And I was going to say that some of the women came with shoes that weren't appropriate for wearing in a camp. You know, they were wearing shoes that with heels and so on. So they couldn't keep those shoes, and they were far better off with the camp supplied shoes. So the camp
supplied shoes were poor quality. They were uncomfortable. Majdanek was a center. Shoes were sent to Majdanek from other camps from all around the concentration camp system for repair. That's why this large amount of shoes are there, because they had the fur and clothing works of the Waffen SS Lublin. They were involved with repairing shoes. They were involved with creating clothing and things like this. This is part of the labor camp. So this is a major center for what one of the biggest things they did at Majdanek was they accepted a lot of these shoes from the camp system and repaired them and redistributed them.
That's right. And so this whole shoe business is another big hoax that they're pulling. You know, if they didn't pull all these big hoaxes, you'd have more sympathy for what was going on in this camp, because apparently it was not a very pleasant place to be. But here's the thing, that I couldn't find that statement, I don't know, about taking care of the health of people. I might not have copied that down because I'm so familiar with it. But on April 30th, 1942, the invasion, just the war in Russia just started in June 41, so this was less than a year into it. Oswald Pohl, the chief of the Economics Administrative Main Office, wrote to Himmler, and he said that the war has brought a visible change in the structure of the concentration camps and has fundamentally altered their responsibilities with regard to which the inmates may be put. the detention of inmates solely for security, educational, or preventive reasons is no longer in the fore. See, and that's what they used to do. They just wanted to get them out of the way, you know, bring them into a camp and control them. So they didn't have to do much, and a little bit of work. Some of them worked if they were able to, if they had something they could have them do. So they didn't need that much. They didn't need really strong shoes or lots of things, you know, and they had a lot of educational programs going on, even the ones that they just wanted, that they made for themselves. At least they did at Auschwitz. But anyway, Paul goes on to say that the emphasis has shifted to economic concerns, mobilizing all inmate labor, first of all, for war-related tasks, for example, increased armaments production, and later on for tasks of peacetime, is becoming more and more important. So they were looking forward to the end of the war, and they would still need labor for building and rebuilding and all kinds of things. So they now were concerned about a labor force. For that, they had to treat people. They treated people differently, and that's when things started to improve in a way, but in another way, people were expected of these prisoners than had been before. So
if you look, Auschwitz as well as Majdanek, which is the real name of Majdanek was Lublin concentration camp. Auschwitz and Lublin were referred to as evacuation camps, mostly at the beginning of the war. As you said, places like Dachau were reserved for political prisoners and actual criminals, communists, things like this. Jews were still just being deported. They weren't really being put to work as much as they were towards the end of the war. If you actually look, there weren't actually that many Jewish prisoners at the beginning of the war in places such as Dachau, camps such as this. It was only, as you said, as the situation changed and they realized they needed more labor to attempt to win the war and turn the tide, that Jews were put to forced labor rather than just be evacuated.
Right, and previously, I mean, the main reason that people were arrested and taken there was because they were doing sabotage. There was all kinds of partisan groups, you know, from the very beginning. And a lot of people were doing that that helped the so-called Polish underground and so on. So when they caught these people, and this sabotage was serious, you know, it was really serious stuff because it killed Germans and killed German troops and hampered the war effort and so on. So these were the people who they were arresting. And then later it became Jews when they decided they had to remove all the Jews. And a lot of these people who were the saboteurs were Jews. So probably more of them than not. So that's how this thing just kept growing. They just kept needing to protect themselves from the people around them because they were in these people's territory. So this is why they were there. And then the whole labor thing got to be so gigantic, the need and so on. So one thing led to another. It developed along these lines. And then what also developed was that the underground and the Poles, with the help of this and working with to some degree, mostly later with the Soviets, let's say the Poles came up with these ideas about gas chamber, gassing human beings, which they had not actually seen, but they came up with this being a good story that they could put out for propaganda. As I think you even said somewhere that they're going to switch from gassing from killing life to killing people. That's what the story was going to switch to, from killing life to killing people, and that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Majdanek is where a lot of this so-called confusion about gas chambers and showers was born. You know, it's very interesting how at Majdanek, there are real showers with a boiler room. No one denies that these are real showers. And the clothing fumigation rooms are completely separate and they're not disguised as shower rooms at all. There are no fake shower heads, but this is what the original, this sort of propaganda became mixed, and when it hit Western audiences and Western propaganda artists, they helped to merge these things and claim that Jews were gassed in the gas chambers, which were disguised as shower rooms with fake shower heads in them. And some of the propaganda artists from the American Psychological Warfare Division, which modified the Dachau, it was originally a real shower room, to the Soviet propaganda artists at Auschwitz, they created this myth. So Maidanek's a huge hole in the gas chamber disguised as shower rooms story, because the shower room is totally separate and actually rooms away from these clothing fumigation rooms at places such as Birkenau. We're told that the actual place they were gassed inside of had, you know, looked actually like a shower room. A lot of the confusion just came from they didn't know that the it came from Maidanek, really, and it developed from Maidanek. This is the first major concentration camp. The Soviets found this Zyklon B pesticide with these skull and crossbones on them.
Yeah, but they knew that already, didn't they? I mean, this brings us into the so-called liberation. Weren't the Poles already putting out the story?
Yeah.
And these were Poles in the concentration camps who had their own underground. These people had a lot of freedom, and they were not a lot of them were trustees, you know, a lot of the Polish, and they had a lot of ability and to use their what those little radio things are and so on, that they could send messages to London and even listen in to their reports and so on, and they had a whole organization going. And the Germans didn't have, they used trustees so much. All the people running the camp were not German. They were, they were Poles and stuff who had jobs as capos and deputies and so on. And they seemed to be very trustworthy. But they were cooperating with their kinsmen. And so, weren't they already talking about, maybe they hadn't mentioned Zyklon B, but they were talking, maybe I'm wrong in that they were talking about killing and gassing and executing, but not saying in what way they were doing it, or maybe that's when they were mentioning carbon monoxide and so on.
It's funny you say that about the Poles, because at Maidanek, even the museum administration admits that I believe 20,000 prisoners were released. They periodically released prisoners from this camp. That's really a poor way to run a so-called death camp or extermination camp. And if they actually were carrying on this extermination program, it would be a really stupid idea to let former prisoners out to go brag to the world. But I think a lot of the rumors...
Really? And why did they release... Do you have any idea why they released... What were the reasons for their releasing prisoners in the early stages? I suppose because they gave them a sentence of a certain amount of time, because it was actually run as they had done something wrong and they were found guilty and they were sent to the camp. And when they served their time, they were released. That's the way it happened at the Auschwitz I.
Hey, it's Arbeit macht frei. It's actually not this deceptive slogan that they claim. They were sentenced to a period of forced labor, and the work makes you free. After you complete your period of work, you'll be free. This happened to many prisoners, thousands upon thousands of prisoners, including some Jews in some of the camps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the policy about Jews changed also over time. You know, early on, they weren't quite so ready to round up all the Jews. But then as time went on, they decided they had to do that. So then it got to be more and more Jews.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, another thing is the openness of the camp. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, you can walk today to Majdanek from the center of the city of Lublin. Lublin is a city in eastern Poland. You can walk from the center of Lublin to Majdanek concentration camp. It's only about a mile and a quarter from the center of the city. It's located on a main road, which also existed at the time of the camp's operation. And it's located in an open field. So this camp was visible during the time of the camp's operation. It was not secret at all. There's nothing secretive about the location of this camp whatsoever. And it's wide open. And these so-called gas chambers are located at the very entrance of the camp. They're the first thing you can see from the road, from the city. So it's quite absurd that they claim that there was some sort of secret extermination program going on there. And
right.
In addition to this, Polish civilian construction firms routinely perform work inside Majdanek to improve the living conditions. And, of course, they would have blown the whistle on any extermination program if it actually existed.
Yeah, if you're planning to have that kind of a program, you're going to put it in some secret forest location or something. You're not going to put it out in the open like that. And all of these camps were pretty much open. Auschwitz-Birkenau was too, although it wasn't so close. But here, the city of Lublin might have grown some, but from your pictures in the camp, you see the city buildings just not very far away at all.
Yeah. It wasn't that much different from today. I mean, certainly the surrounding buildings have grown since then, but it wasn't too much different from back then. The road which people drive on today was the same road that existed, and you can look right out at the camp from there.
Yeah, so they say it's surrounded on one side by a road, another side by the outskirts of a couple of settlements, villages, I guess, and the other edge up to the suburb of Lublin, I guess, Kosmiec, and then the other is by another village called Kalinowka. So everybody can go there and see what's there, and know nothing was hidden away. And so that just tells you right there. There's so many simple little things that already will say, well, this can't have been this, or it wouldn't have been built like this.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why the Holocaust industry is embarrassed about Majdanek. This is one of the reasons why Westerners and, of course, Americans don't really know much or haven't really heard that much about Majdanek, especially because of the death toll, which is really nothing like what is alleged at Auschwitz. Auschwitz became the more popular camp for propaganda purposes. Majdanek, for a variety of reasons, has become the forgotten so-called death camp. In fact, most Holocaust promoters have downgraded it and no longer even call it a death camp or extermination camp. They're quite embarrassed about it.
Well, so there you go. So so this is the one to really push through, perhaps, because they know they've got a bad deal going there, and they're trying to not even talk about it. They don't even want to bring it up. Maybe that's why they make such a big deal about Auschwitz for their 70th anniversary day, which maybe they thought that was foolproof there, which they're wrong about that, too. And then there's the window in the gas, in the so-called gas chamber, which doesn't ever go away. They've never been able to pretend that window's not there. It's still there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they used to call this an experimental gas chamber, where Zyklon B was thrown through the holes in the ceiling. But they've been forced to admit that this was just used for fumigation when not used by prisoners. So they can't get away from the physical evidence that currently exists at Majdanek, which acquits the Germans of these ridiculous charges. So this is why they like to push these camps where that were destroyed both by the Germans and the Soviets, such as Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor. They moved the 2 million that they claimed was gassed at Majdanek to these camps where there is very little physical evidence to today, such as those three camps.
Yeah. Well, so I'm not clear, I guess. Has the officials at Majdanek stopped calling it a death camp? Have they said that there was no gas chamber, that there was only experimental gassings, or isn't it still considered to have a gas chamber?
So originally they claimed there were seven homicidal gas chambers at Majdanek. In 2005 is when Tomas Kranz, the research director of the Majdanek State Museum, he tried to play damage control. He's trying to make this crude Soviet propaganda hoax more believable for the modern audiences. So he jettisoned five of these seven chambers, alleged homicidal gas chambers. So now they claim only two of these rooms were ever used to gas prisoners. Now, if you actually look at these rooms, which were next to the bath and disinfection one facility, they were used in conjunction with the clothing with the delousing facility. One of the rooms is an obvious delousing chamber. It's got Prussian blue staining all over the walls,
right.
And
okay.
It has no hole in the ceiling. So there's no way this could ever have been used.
And no
to,
windows.
To gas
no windows
prisoners.
On this one. This was a real disinfection gas chamber.
Yeah, it was
for clothes. With Zyklon B being used and so on. Well,
yeah.
How did they do this?
There's no
hole. There's no window. How did they use the Zyklon B for that to disinfect the clothing there?
As I show in my video, which the U.S. Coast Guard actually used similar cyanide-based insecticide on their ships. What they do is they spread the material around inside the chamber. They've got a crew. They're wearing gas masks, and they close. Then they leave the room. They close off the room. They usually put up a warning sign so no one accidentally goes in the room. Then there's a heater attached to the fumigation room that they turn on in order to hasten the release of the cyanide gas. Zyklon B was designed as a slow-releasing pesticide in order to save the lives of those spreading it around. So unlike Auschwitz and places such as Dachau, which had they're called degesh, delousing mechanisms, the Zyklon B was spread around probably on the floor, such as that shown of the U.S. Coast Guard doing a similar thing.
I've got that clear now.
One of the things I haven't gotten to is that Carlo Mattonio pointed this out first, was that they also claim that carbon monoxide in bottles was used to gas prisoners. So what happens when you actually look, the museum has two bottles on display, gas bottles apparently. When you actually look at them, they're labeled CO2, carbon dioxide, not carbon monoxide. So carbon monoxide, it's a deadly poisonous gas with very few industrial uses, but carbon dioxide is used all around the world every day for a variety of purposes. The museum they claim carbon monoxide, CO, was used to gas prisoners, yet on display are two bottles of CO2, carbon dioxide. Carlo Mattonio and Jürgen Graf theorized that if CO2 was actually used in these rooms, it's quite possible they were used when these two alleged gas chambers were converted into makeshift morgues the high inmate death toll. And at the time, before the new crematorium was constructed, Majdanek only had two oil-fueled cremation ovens. So the bottleneck of any extermination program is corpse disposal. So if there are only two oil-fueled ovens, there's no possible way they could be participating in an extermination program where rooms full of Jews were being gassed and then somehow made into ash. So these rooms, Carlo Matonio and Jürgen Graf, they claim that these rooms temporarily had to serve as makeshift morgues, and if the CO2 was actually in this place, it could have been used to prevent to preserve the corpses before cremation. CO2 is used to prevent oxidation, and it can also be used as a bit of a coolant. But there are several other uses CO2 could have been used for at this spot, including combined with another chemical to form a pesticide to be used on clothing.
So therefore, they don't have any gas. They can't even claim a gas chamber there anymore. Do they not really try to do that? Are they just
kind of backing off? They're backing off because of the revisionists such as David McAlden and Andrew Allen, who I believe almost three decades ago made a video about Majdanek called The Holocaust Revisited. They pointed out all the flaws in these gas chambers, and many of the rooms that were formerly alleged are no longer alleged to have been used to gas anyone. You've got the work of Matonio and Graf. So a lot of the works of revisionists have forced the Majdanek Museum to back away from their homicidal claims. However, they still claim two of these rooms were used. One of them they claim was used for carbon dioxide. This is the long room with the Prussian blue staining on the walls and the heater attached to it. The room next to it they claim was used for Zyklon B and carbon monoxide. However, this room has none of this large and obvious Prussian blue staining on the walls, and it has one of these similar post-liberation holes in the roof, which was crudely formed, and just like the other rooms that they admit were never used to gas anyone. So I think the biggest flaw today is what I pointed out in the video, which hasn't really been brought to anyone's attention in the way it should, which is that the Majdanek Museum today, they are mislabeling rooms to claim this old Soviet propaganda claim that inmates were tricked into these showers, and then they thought they were okay, and then they were tricked into gas chambers afterwards. Majdanek Museum is walking gullible tourists through these facilities the opposite way. They never went the way that tourists are herded in today. So this alone just demolishes their claims that these other two rooms, which were used in conjunction with the bath and disinfection rooms, were ever used to deceive prisoners into walking into gas chambers after taking showers.
You know what I'd like to see, Eric? I'd like to see about 500 people descend on Majdanek with posters and, you know, handheld and banners and so on, protesting against the falsity of what's going on there, and maybe a slogan like, you know, no gas chambers or something like that, and force these people. They'd have to bring out a lot of police to stop them, you know, and just make a march through there and force them to react or respond to this. All these questions, which they just try to ignore.
Well, they can't really. Yeah, I would like to see that too. I don't think many people have the courage to do that. Of course, in Poland, it's still very illegal to publicly deny this vicious lie.
That's what they've reduced themselves to, isn't it? I mean, when you come down to it, then there's always those laws that they pass. to prevent people from saying anything. Yeah, it's a, that's a, well, I think you've done a terrific job of exposing this and exposing it further, and there's no question but that watching a video is far more accessible than reading a book. With a lot of detail in it and so on. So this is it's a great contribution. And let's talk a little bit about what you need to continue with your work. You know, and we mentioned it just a little bit in the beginning, what the Holocaust industry has, the many millions and so on. And you are interested in needing to get some better equipment. You've got plans for, I don't want to go into that at all, but, you know, you're not finished with this video. You're not finished with what you can do. But you need better equipment, more professional equipment. And you're wanting to do that. And what kind of a figure, you know, put a figure on it that what you need in order to continue on. And don't be afraid of making it as much as it needs to be, because there's a lot of people out there and there's a lot of loose money floating around. There's no reason that it can't be going to projects like this and to somebody like you. It's going to go somewhere.
Yeah. If you watch my videos, I've put out 3 videos this year. I've been able to improve the quality in each one. However, this to continue to improve the quality, more money is needed. When I visited the camp, I shot the footage I took on a camera phone, which it's pretty good quality, but really we need a professional quality camera. We need funding to help cover some travel costs and my own costs of working on this, and I'm really willing to do a lot more films and documentaries, and I hope people can see how much hard work has gone into this. And the only thing really holding me back at this point is proper funding. So we need a few $1,000s to buy proper camera equipment to cover travel expenses and my own expenses so that I can continue to improve these projects and make really quality revisionist videos. I've tried to add some short 3D animation to this video. I think really the thing that's, we have the truth on our side. We just really need some better equipment, better funding to keep improving our production values. And I think people can see that in every video I've done, production values have improved. I've been able to buy better sound equipment, and I'm just trying to keep improving. I think the other side, the liars, the hoaxers, they have these really slick Hollywood videos that really trick people, and we have the truth on our side, but we really do need to approach professional level image and sound quality, and this could only be done with money, really. So
yeah.
Hopefully some people can...
Well, I think you should set a goal, I mean an immediate goal, not a long-term goal, but just for immediately, you need $10,000, you'd like to raise $10,000, because there are lots of associated costs besides just buying a few new pieces of equipment. So, you know, and that's not too much to ask. You know, I was thinking today, I say whatever comes to my mind, so I don't know how well it applies, but you know, over at the website Countercurrents, he has a fundraiser at least twice a year, and gets his goal is like $20,000 or something, and he reaches it because he's putting it out there, and all he does over there is promote homosexuality, really, and some kind of new right, new American right thinking. You know, this is so much more valuable. And we just need to get more aggressive with fundraising. And I just know that if you want to raise money, you really have to keep asking for it and getting in people's faces about it. Otherwise, they just conveniently don't think about it. So I know you don't like to do that. You're not the kind of a person that would do that. Maybe you need somebody to do it for you. But over at Countercurrents, Mr. Johnson is one of those people. He doesn't mind doing it. He's pretty good at it. But most people aren't. But I would say you need at least to set a goal for $10,000 for the next few months and see if we try to come up with some ways to get people to let go of some and to direct some of their extra money over your way. And you do have a PayPal. They can send it to you via PayPal at your website, which is, once again, holocausthoax.com. No, that's right. Is that the full name of it?
HolocaustHoaxMuseum.com.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I left out the museum. HolocaustHoaxMuseum.com. And if they want to do otherwise, what would you say to the people who don't use PayPal?
We have an address on the site that you can send money to anonymously. Yeah, we've been able to put out 3 feature-length documentaries this year. We've been able to travel and shoot new footage at both Treblinka and Majdanek. Also on the website, we visited the Travniki labor camp site. We'd like to tour, visit more of these camps and make more documentaries and improve the image quality, improve the audio quality, make these slick presentations. And I'd like to do more 3D animation for the videos. We can defeat these liars, but I think certainly some people are turned off by some of the crudeness in our past presentations. We're trying to really make them more slick. This is basically the main reason people actually believe in this nonsense about shower rooms of death, is these violins playing in the background and the,
there you go, really
crisp images. So we could use the help to improve our quality. I hope if you see our new video, you can see how we're really trying to do everything we can on our limited budget to make it as high quality as we can right now. But certainly money could really help.
Well, it's necessary.
Yeah.
It's not even a matter of it just if it's possible, but it's really necessary. And I don't know anybody who's doing what you're doing. I don't know anybody who's doing quite what you're doing, Eric, and really putting out videos and films like this. Are there? Do you want to give some credit to somebody else here or what?
Well, I mean, see, Denier Bud was...
Oh, yeah, Denier Bud, that's right.
But, I mean, he gave up because his funding dried up. He has to make a living, and I'm the only one silly enough to keep going at this, but I think it's really important to me. You know, my grandfather was an American World War II vet, and we're the victims of this massive scam, and somehow I was born with the capacity to see through this BS, and I have some filmmaking ability, so I'd really like to continue making educational documentaries for the revisionist movement.
We'll keep working on seeing that you're able to do it, Eric. And I want to thank you so much for all the work you've done and for this latest film, which, as you said, people can watch on your website after the show. And we will be keeping in touch and keeping moving along with this and hope for the best. So thanks so much, Eric. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Yeah, the video should be up in about an hour or two, so look out for that.
Okay. I certainly will. So this has been Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on December 6th. Bye, all.